Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, new MacBooks, Phong tessellation versus MSAA. What makes Mac's pane look pretty? The Ultimate Gaming Notebook doesn't have a Retina display. Western Digital's making routers. AMD's Fusion Developers Summit SSDs and graphics driver are coming a little less awesome. And yes, there are new Mac Pros. They're all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 174, recorded June 14th, 2012. Phong tessellation and retina displays. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWICH6, that's T-W-I-C-H-6. And Squarespace now offers free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit TV's weekly show where we try to bring you the best and most exciting news in hardware, answer your viewer questions, and give you a feel for what's worth your money and what's not worth your money when you're thinking about picking up a new PC or a tablet or maybe even a smartphone. Okay, mostly we're about the PCs. Occasionally we're about the tablets. Ryan Shrout, our normal co-host, is in flight somewhere to somewhere doing something he will not reveal. We got Robert Herron from Herron Fidelity, HD Nation, and Techzilla with us. Robert Herron, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you, Pat. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm excited.
You sound great. Good. Technology
is the
fun.
Absolutely fantastic Heil microphone hooked into the lovely M Audio digital to analog converter. Actually, analog to digital converter. It's a fast track.
Got my sweet Plantronics USB headset on. It seems to be working okay.
It hasn't exploded yet. I want to take a moment to remind everybody, Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv is our email address. We'd love to hear your questions and hear what you guys are looking at, thinking about buying, or new and exciting bits of hardware you'd like us to cover on the show. And I got to ask, Robert, you know, for anybody who's not familiar with Robert Herron, which probably means you don't watch Techzilla, and that makes me sad.
Me too.
Or HD Nation, which also makes me sad if you don't watch it. What's going on in the home theater and HDTVs this week? What has you excited?
Probably the single best flat panel available right now is sitting in our studio in San Francisco, the VT50 series from Panasonic, the new 2012 panel. They're top-of-the-line panel. It'll have the darkest black levels it should of all of their plasmas. I believe they're ultra panel. In addition, it has just superb motion performance, and I'll be able to connect to it over my local network connection for adjusting the TV. And actually, the software I use for calibration will be able to communicate over the local network. So rather than me play with the remote to make adjustments, I'm going to have the software control the TV directly over the local network. This has been available for a while, but usually you're doing it over a serial connection. Nowadays, it seems that the better TVs are going straight for a network connection or an IP-based adjustment and access to the TV's controls. That, and it also opens up some possibilities for automating some of the calibration steps that go into the setup of the TV to make it look great. So anything that can speed it up, make it look better, and take advantage of hardware I'm already using to work on these sets, I'm all for it. So that I'm really excited about. And I also have one of the new plus Y or plus yellow colored Sharp LCD panels, and one of their top of the line. Oh, which one is it? I'm going to say it's the 60-inch, the LE847U, and I'm really kind of looking for it. It'll be the first 4 sub-pixel colored set I've looked at and actually tested, so I'm curious to see how it
handles. Did you do one of their extra Y pixel televisions probably 3 or 4 years ago? It's basically, they pack an extra yellow pixel
for a while. Totally, yeah. Instead of having the traditional red, blue, and green sub-pixels that if you put a magnifying glass up to any TV right now, you will see tiny little red, blue, and green dots that combine to make the colors you see per pixel. And with the Sharp technology and their 4-color pixel, they're adding yellow, which rather than just mixing red and green light to get yellow, you actually have a dedicated pixel for that. A couple of benefits. One, it actually creates a Well, one, you get more pixels on the screen. More subpixels could create a smoother arc. So if you're creating curved lines or edges, you get less aliasing. That's one possibility. The other main reason, though, really, I think it's just for 3D, so that you're putting more light out regardless of what you're showing on the screen. Just having a larger aperture in their panel technology to let more light through, and the and other aspects of the panel itself. This is coming from their Gen 10 plant in Sakai City, Japan, and that's their state-of-the-art facility for creating LCD panels. And Sharp's technology really is the extra brightness also goes into its 3D capabilities, which, as we know, with active technology for the glasses, you're losing about at least half the brightness. So this is one way to help compensate for that. But in addition to those two items, display side, I'm also looking at just some new, I finally got in the mail about, I got to say about 6 months ago, I put in an order for something called the Color Hug, an open source color measurement tool. And I finally got it in the mail. And this is the little gem right here, straight from customs. Mm-hmm. Took forever to get through. And this is the first I'm aware of is basically an open source photon counter. It contains a pixel array inside of here that'll measure specifically red, blue, and green wavelengths of light, in addition to a clear pixel as well that'll measure just luminance. And using open source software, I'm able to then create color profiles on monitors right now. And hopefully I'll be able to actually incorporate this into some of my HDTV stuff as well. But an open source tool, available with open source drivers and open source software, kind of a first of its kind. I'm just getting my feet wet with it, and that's got me going at the moment, in addition to about 50 other little things I'm working on right now. And I just backed up a hard drive that I had rebuilt the system on, so if you haven't backed up your data lately, do that too.
We'll talk some about data backup.
Clonezilla saves me every day.
It's a good thing. It's kind of funny. The part of the big deal about the Husky Color Hug is compared to, it's like, I think the UK price is like £60. So it's like 100, 110 right. bucks US. It doesn't do printer calibration. It doesn't do self calibration, unlike, say, the X-Rite Color Monkey.
Right.
But you're talking about some pretty inexpensive open source color calibration. So your monitor is the color.
Relatively high performance, too, in terms of how many samples per minute, say, it'll take. So you're not waiting very long. And the ICC profile, apparently you'll be able to generate with the open source software. You could apply that to any operating system platform that supports ICC color profiles. And if you've never had your monitor color profiled, you're really missing out, because no monitor is perfect, and every monitor can benefit from being properly calibrated. And creating an ICC profile, actually measuring the output of the monitor and doing basically a mathematical correction to it, and that applies to everything you look at except gaming, unfortunately. But it applies to your rest of your desktop doings, and it's a neat thing to do if you have access to that hardware and can do it.
I need to borrow that just long enough to calibrate the two monitors on my desk at work. Because since I plugged the second one into my Windows 8 box, I'm like, oh, white, bluish white.
I also I've also got a piece of software, too, that it's a commercial piece of software that works with my calibration software, where I can load that on a computer. And that will take, it will allow me then to program and create those ICC profiles for any display system. But that's more of a Windows-based thing. This is more of open source, and overall, you can really get the cost down. But like you said, not every feature is there for every type of application yet, especially if you're doing print work. Maybe that might be the tool for it. So stuff to keep in mind, but it's kind of the first of its kind, and pretty cool at that.
Very cool, actually. We're going to breeze through what's probably the biggest news in hardware this week, the Worldwide Developers Conference, which was 4 days ago, which is like 1,000 years in internet hardware news. But I'm going to say the biggest news this week, probably the Retina display and the USB 3.0 and the even thinner design on the new MacBook Pro. Retina display, by the way, something it took me a couple days to figure out, only available on the 15-inch models. If you've been thinking about buying a 17-inch MacBook Pro, you're either going to Craigslist or you're going to the refurbished section at the Apple store, because the 17-inch model is gone. The lunch tray is going away, which made a couple of our video editors here start to weep, because they love that big giant 17-inch monitor and they wanted to see like a Retina display on a gigantic lunch tray side monitor. The 2560 by 1440 Retina display, $2,200 for that computer. That's $400 over the regular 15-inch MacBook Pro.
That doesn't sound too much of a steep VIG, I guess you could call it. No?
Well, it's still a healthy vig. It's like a 25% price increase almost. Our buddy Cal Weens from iFixit did an opinion piece for Wired. iFixit, of course, does teardowns of new hardware. The company's raison d'etre abuse the French is essentially talking about how to repair. You know, iFixit, they started as hardware repair, iPod repair, MacBook repair, and Kyle and his crew are all about repairing anything these days. But of course, their core business is still providing parts for repair of MacBooks and iPods and iPhones. I've availed myself of several iPhone screens from them. But it was interesting. They did the teardowns. If you want to see the incredible collection of batteries inside the new MacBook Pro, you can go up to iFixit.com. Wow. It's pretty crazy. Quote, the Retina MacBook is the least repairable laptop we've ever taken apart. The display is fused to the glass, which means to get a new LCD is essentially buying an entire display assembly, even worse than the MacBook Airs. The RAM is soldered to the logic board, so there's no memory upgrade options ever. The battery is glued to the case. So battery upgrades
Buy it the way you like it, because that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah,
well, not necessarily a bad thing either, in my mind. I mean, as long as you get it fully loaded to the spec level you're comfortable with, I wouldn't want to shortchange a build on that system because you're getting one shot at it.
Well, I think part of it's Kyle's primary issue is like, look, you've got a finite use count on lithium ion batteries, which means best case scenario, you're spending $200 to send it to Apple to replace the batteries. And, you know, when he starts looking at stuff, he's not only thinking about the first buyer, but maybe the second and third owner of this computer being able to keep it up and running. The other issue that he pointed out is because the glass is fused to the aluminum, it may be a highly recyclable design composed of aluminum and glass, but it may be assembled in a way that makes it enormously difficult to recycle. But it's an interesting read that really discusses, you know, the fact that Apple is at the forefront of these beautiful, sleek, well-designed products, but they're also at the forefront of making stuff that is almost impossible to repair, at least at home. Another piece of news that actually didn't come out at Worldwide Developers Conference in the keynotes is there are actually new Mac Pros.
what?
They didn't mention it. Yeah. The company... I'm going to say, where did it go? I've actually found it up in the LA Times, of all places. We're listing it. The cheapest Mac Pro is a 3.2 gigahertz quad-core Intel Xeon processor with 6 gigs of RAM and 1 terabyte of storage. Starts at $2,500. The $3,800 model has two 2.4 gigahertz 6-core Intel Xeon processors, 12 gigabytes of RAM, and a 1 terabyte drive. And they have a server version for $3,000. And as somebody who works at an organization with Mac servers or had a lot of Mac servers, do yourself a favor. Buy a server from a real server company.
Ooh. That's, ow.
I'm just saying.
That's personal experience right there.
They just don't really have enterprise computer service anymore. So if you're, you know,
they have server goes looking down, workstations, though.
Or your XSAN goes down, they'll send you one in 2 weeks. And then you'll find out they sent you one that's dead because they don't actually check them before they send them, which is something that every other delete expletive hardware company that makes servers does. I'm just saying.
That's unacceptable.
Bitter. I'm angry.
Just about that.
Not Apple hardware news. Do you want to talk about the obscene Origin Eon 17S gaming notebook?
Always.
It's got rave. PCPer.com says it's, quote, easily the fastest laptop that PCPer's ever reviewed.
Dang, man. I'm always curious just graphics-wise. That seems to be always the great limiter, and that's the one thing, if I could point to Thunderbolt being appealing to me in any way, really, is to be able to put a full graphics package into a notebook, even in an external form, just having that available as an option. Because otherwise, you've got the CPU power, memory speed, everything else is there as far as what I would want in a gaming notebook. But... as long as you're willing to sacrifice a little, I guess, on the graphic side of things, either in terms of resolution or in detail, you can still get a plenty good experience. I'm not dissing. I'm sure this is the finest notebook currently available. But but if you're talking a 2 or 3 megapixel display, that's right. And you're trying to drive that at a smooth 60 frames a second with everything cranked up. That's where you really need desktop graphics hardware. In my humble opinion.
Interesting. The the Eon 17S, it's a Core i7-3920XM, which is running at like 4.4 gigahertz when you overclock it. NVIDIA GTX 675, 2 gigabytes of RAM, 16 gigs of DDR3. Obviously, an obscenely overconfigured test bed. 220 gigabyte SSDs in RAID 0, plus a 1 terabyte 5400 RPM hard drive.
That's ridiculous. 17.3
inch 1080p screen, 77 watt hour lithium ion battery, weighs 8.6 pounds. This is not something you're going to use to compute all the way to Australia by any stretch of the imagination.
You still lose trim support, do you not, though, when you start raiding SSDs? I thought that was the case with that. That was one reason not to do that. And really, I mean, with USB, with 6 gigabit per second performance with USB now, or even in hardware, I mean, do you really need to be raiding SSDs in RAID 0? I don't know. It just, or at least with SATA, I'm thinking. So
crazy. It's interesting. Did you take a look at the benchmarks? It's kind of funny. It's like they're using Dawn of War 2 Retribution. So max frames per second, 190 frames per second, minimum 52, the average about 100.96. That's running at 1366 by 768 with medium detail. And Just Cause 2, 59.82 frames per second. That's with low detail in the Concrete Jungle Loop. Let's see, Deus Ex Human Resolution, maxed out at 172 frames per second, average 105. Skyrim, maxed out at 225 frames per second, average of 157. And that's a huge boost over the Asus G75V, which is one of the big gaming notebooks that people have been reviewing this year. Battlefield 3, 94 frames per second, average, running at 1366 by 768. 1080p medium detail, 61 frames per second on average, peaked at 99, minimum was 43. So I think it's actually, even at high detail, it was still averaging like 48 frames per second. So at 1080p. So that's pretty impressive.
I'm trying to see, what was the native resolution of the display? Oh, it's a 1080p display. 1080p. So they're running that at half resolution for the gaming and getting acceptable performance out of it. And that's an acceptable trade-off, really, especially on a smaller display. Cutting the resolution of your source or the game in this case down by half resolution, say to 720p, and then except for in case of Battlefield where they're running it at 1080, but with medium detail. But those are games too, which really, when you crank up to high detail, is where they really start to look good as well. So, but still, the fact that you can run these at all on a notebook platform with acceptable performance and have a great time doing it, that's awesome.
It's a good thing. Matt Smith wrote the review for PC Per. He notes that this is a $3,500 notebook as it's configured, but if you dump the Extreme Edition processor, you drop $1,000 off the price of the notebook.
You could do it with probably the RAID 0 SSD is one that gets paid too.
That's probably another $300-$400 off the price. So Origin Eon 17S, if you have the bank, could be the epic notebook. Another thing we found up on PCPro.com Tech Gauge, quote, recently took a look at the effect enabling tessellation and anti-aliasing had on the visual quality of Max Payne 3. Visually, the Phong tessellation, which if you're not particularly familiar with, the FXAA, which is fast approximate anti-aliasing, basically ignores polygons and edges. So FXAA and 4X MSAA had more effect. Yeah, FXAA.
It's essentially applying like an anti-aliasing algorithm to the entire scene rather than looking at specific edges and things like that. It almost takes like a JPEG of the frame as it's being rendered. It says, you know what, so the key benefit really is that if you have transparencies in the scene that normally wouldn't be anti-aliased, like say you're looking through a fence texture, I could be getting this wrong, but essentially you're anti-aliasing everything in the scene rather than, in some cases, just certain objects because of the way the engine works. And that's one of the benefits. But looking at the tessellation pictures they're showing there, I see little or no difference. And if anything, I like the lighting better with it off in that picture. but then again, these are relatively small pictures, and I'm not looking at the full screenshot here. Yeah. So, but still,
well, the
FXAA in a lot of games nowadays, and I believe NVIDIA was the company to get that ball rolling.
Right.
It also provides this anti-aliasing at very little overhead. So you're able to enable this with just about any title nowadays, whether or not it was built to support FXAA from the ground up or not. And you're getting a better picture out of it with, like I said, little overhead. So it's almost like a free version of anti-aliasing. It's worth checking out, especially with the latest graphics drivers on all the platforms, I believe now, not just NVIDIA anymore.
It's funny, TechGage pointed out, quote, Tessellation did little more than bulk up character clothing. And they said that's almost non-distinguishable unless you're looking at the images side by side. The thing they said is they look at that MSAA versus very high FXAA versus 4X MSAA. And they basically said minor improvements for a 50% frame rate hit. So if you are thinking about 3D graphics and you're kind of curious about Fong tessellation, because really Rockstar did some work to make sure Max Payne would have some shiny for the PC players, definitely check out the article at TechGage. See the news that Western Digital makes routers now?
That freaked me out. I'm like, okay, the world is now going topsy-turvy and everyone's just spreading out their product line a little bit to ensure they're capturing whatever market's available. If they make a good product, though, I will buy it. So I'm not going to just poo-poo a router product or a network gear from Western Digital just because it's what I think of as a storage company. I'm willing to take a look and I'm actually in the market for a new router right now too, to replace my so-called N router. I'd like to get a true dual band router. And now these new AC routers are coming out but what the hell is Western Digital up to? Are they anything cool? Anything catch your eye?
You know, is there Alan wrote the review up at PCPer.com. He was, quote, pleasantly surprised by Western Digital's entry into the high-end router sector. Class-leading chipset and specs, simple configuration, good feature set, fast-track traffic shaping, which is really cool, the idea of some really decent traffic shaping inside of a router. No watchdog or automated to reboot. Quote, it must be manually reset if it ever freezes. He gave it an editor's choice. The one thing we don't have right now is an actual ship date for it. So if Alan's in the chat room, maybe you can chime in on that. But it's kind of funny because it's been really interesting to watch non-IT companies. You know what I mean? You normally think of it as like, oh, okay, there's these companies that do routers, D-Link, for example, or that one I won't buy anymore because of the incidents in my home with being really frustrated. That would be Linksys.
I feel your pain.
Linksys routers sitting in a box.
I've been on a D-Link binge lately. A lot of D-Link routers in my lifestyle. Stuff. Or in my recent history.
You know, and updates are really nice too. But where did it go? I love the moment where I lose the really useful spot on the web page. But it was funny. I guess Alan thought he was going to see, because Alan normally covers storage, and he thought he was going to need to see some kind of a hard drive, and it's a router. Four ports of fast Ethernet, 7X Gigi switching, all models, basically four different models from the N600 up to the N900. All models support some form of simultaneous dual band 2.4 and 5 gigahertz with a minimum of 2x2 and scaling up to 3x3 configurations. There's some interesting stuff going on here. All models have USB 2.0 connectivity for storage devices. And at the top of the line, they'll have an integrated like 1 or 2 terabyte, 2.5 inch hard drive, which is pretty cool. That'll actually be integrated inside of the box.
Nice. So, or more popular. Everyone I know is trying to get some kind of network-attached storage going. So, and if the router can do it and you can just add a hard drive to that, well, there you go. There's a good thing to do. Or share a printer. There's the other big popular item with routers now, too. I just picked up that Asus, what is the 66U. That's the last router I picked up, more for a true dual-band router. And pretty pleased with it overall, especially once you get the firmware updated. That's another one I'd throw out there as a good higher-end router. I think I paid about $170 for it, so it's not for everyone. But if you're looking for true dual-band, high performance, good range, all that good stuff, and lots of built-in features, I liked it. Liked it a lot.
I will say I really like the interface on that Western Digital router. Looks really clean, like the control for the individual devices on the DHCP table entries, the wireless setup. There's a lot of detail inside of there.
See, it's the little things. I love having those features, especially if they all work. Like going back to my Asus router issues, that's a router where it has, you know, the ability to do time updates and things like that. But the thing sometimes just forgets what time it is and resets back to defaults. And it's not a huge letdown, but there's little glitches in firmware like that sometimes get me. And I'm hoping to see that Western Digital really focuses on their software to make sure it's tight. Because that really, it has to be reliable. Otherwise, you suddenly just, you don't like it if it's not. It has to be.
You know what? I think maybe the coolest thing that, that Alan found inside of it, firmware updating from within the firmware itself on the router. So you don't have to hunt it down and download it so you can update. Yeah. Why is this so hard, router companies?
I just dealt with a Cisco / I think it's Linksys now. Linksys is owned by Cisco. And that router needed a firmware update. And it had none available. It was like you had to actually go to the website, find the specific support page. Hopefully you could figure out then which version of the hardware you had and then download the correct file. When it's so nice nowadays, most of the new routers, at least I'm seeing, will offer that feature where it will check on a regular basis to see if there's an update and then actually either ping you and notify you that it's available, or I don't think any of them are just automatically straight up updating the firmware without your interaction, though. So I don't know if you'd want that either. It'd be nice to have the option, but anything that can help me keep my firmware updated, I'm all for it.
Anything that means I don't have to, like, first you download it, then you copy it, then you bring it up, and then you find it, and then you hit the thing, and then you wait for it to reboot, then you go kick the cat. I'm kidding. I did, beloved large belly cat.
I did two firmware updates today. I did one on that older PC I mentioned earlier, and then I did a router firmware update too today. It's been a firmware heavy day.
It's firmware Thursday here. Seriously. Oh my goodness. Of course, there's new SSD lineup toggles between Marvell and SandForce models. Another write-up from PCPro.com. It's interesting. Quote, Corsair's 256GB Performance Pro SSD is the member of the Performance Series, which utilizes Toshiba Toggle NAND and the Marvell 9174 controller. At $340, it's a little more expensive than some other comparable drives. However, that may be well-deserved. After their testing, Hard OCP put this drive in the same category as the Intel 520 in general performance. And apparently found it actually faster than the Intel 520, which is pretty good stuff. That's a review up at Hard OCP from our buddies over there, Kyle Bennett, the editor over at Hard OCP. This one was written up by Hugh Briggs. It's really interesting. They're mixing. They have multiple controllers in their lineup, which is something I don't think we've seen. An individual line from a company like this lineup has this CPU in this lineup, this lineup has that particular asset. You know, multiple controllers separated by lineup, but actually the same lineup from Corsair having both Marvell and SandForce controllers. That's something we haven't really seen before.
And SandForce's design, at least the original chipset design, was set up so that they could mix and match different memory types and still achieve an acceptable level of performance. They left a lot of overhead, I guess, in place. And some of the newer designs are actually tightening up on that to help eke out even better performance, but with perhaps a limited number of compatible hardware that goes into that part. But I'm telling you, every time, I still say SSDs are the greatest invention of late in computing. Just that storage performance, when you get used to it and you don't have it, like today I put together a small system using a standard notebook drive, and just about every other system in my house right now has an SSD boot drive, and it's painful. you feel the time ticking away when you're dealing with a very slow transfer rate on a notebook drive compared to something like an SSD, especially a notebook hardware. That's where you really, I think, notice a lot of the difference too, where you can add that high-speed storage to it to help give it a little extra oomph. Always nice.
Extra oomph is always good. Another write-up from Alan up at PCPro.com. IOSafe Solo Pro and the Synology DiskStation 212 Plus disaster-proof network storage. You know, it's kind of funny, you know, as Alan points out in the lead graph of the articles, cloud storage is what everybody's thinking about, whether it's Carbonite, who of course is a sponsor over at Techzilla, or CrashPlan, or any of the 34,000 other online storage providers, which now includes like Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon, and probably my dog, if I haven't been watching her closely enough, probably has an online storage, cloud storage. in some cases, either the volume of work you have isn't going to make it work, or the fact that you have maybe satellite internet or something. And the idea is that, you know, so you got a local copy, a local backup, and Alan points out RAID is not a backup, and an additional offsite backup. So what's been happening from a couple of manufacturers, notably IOSafe with Solo Pro, is that they are building like waterproof, fireproof enclosures that contain RAID. So it's kind of funny. In the inside of one of it's available 1, 2, 3, or 4 terabyte 3.5 inch hard drives. On the outside, it's a very durable and soluble steel enclosure. The drive is wrapped in a thermally conductive yet water-resistant hydro-safe foil that enables water resistance rated at 10-foot depth for 3 days with no data loss. The bonus, however, is not the water resistant that features present primarily to battle the side effects of something much more drastic. The IOSafe is fireproof.
Come with drive recovery already paid for if you need it. And I think that's really the big deal. Yeah. I mean, man, as long as that service is included, because I've seen nothing but very, very large estimates, generally speaking, for getting data recovered off of a damaged hard drive, especially IOSafe.
Basically, the purchase price includes from IOSafe, I think it's up to $5,000 per terabyte of data.
I love excavators. You're going to nail that drive with this? Oh, you're only dropping it? Oh, that's disappointing. Yeah.
I actually had this in for review, so if you want to get together, we can barbecue it this weekend. I actually thought I was going to have the opportunity to put it into a Foundry blaster. But unfortunately, our contact at that organization no longer works there. And the person who is there is like, you want to do what with my what? Go away. Strange, insane person. The disk stations, the Synology disk station was the other product, which is, quote, an excellent NAS multitasker that does not skimp in features or speed. And the IOSafe offers insane levels of data protection, fire, flooding, lightning, ponies. They're expensive, but they give you a lot of protection for what you're paying for.
Did this drive survive this tread of being run over by the excavator?
That's the one I had on set, and I was... Is that the one I had on set? No. I have the IOSafe rugged portable, and I threw it out of my car at 30 miles an hour, and it bounced down the highway quite happily. But that's... You know, editor's choice for the IOSafe Solo Pro. Synology Disk Station gets the gold award for its speedy performance and flexibility. And quote, the fact that I'm still finding new features weeks after I fired the thing up. How freaking cool is that, people?
Hey, it's like Christmas. Gotta love it. New stuff.
Oh my goodness. Workstation people, AMD's new FirePro W600 puts 6 mini display ports in one slot. It's interesting. It's just a lot of many display ports. That's for firing up a lot of models for you psychotic CAD CAM users. And Ryan forwarded some news from the AMD Fusion Developer Summit, where he's been this week. AMD, ARM, TI, Imagination, and MediaTek have joined to form the HSA Foundation. Ryan says, this is an open commitment. He typed this up for us. This is an open commitment to bring the idea of a heterogeneous computing system, one that does not separate CPU from GPU at all, one that shares an address space to multiple platforms other than just AMD. We knew that AMD was going to build an HSA processor sometime in 2014 that meets all the requirements, but now that major system-on-a-chip vendors and ARM are on board, they will be all doing the same thing as well. This does not mean that ARM is going x86 or that AMD is going ARM, but rather there will be a new virtual ISA that these hardware companies will have to adhere to, making it infinitely easier for software developers to program to take advantage of parallel and serial computing resources. Now, this is more of a big iron type of thing, enterprise server type stuff, but it's got some interesting possibilities. Ryan says the goal is to make it very easy for even the most basic programmers to take advantage of parallel computing without even thinking about it. Compared to OpenCL in its current form, HSA Foundation's goal is to make it much easier to program. The other big news is that AMD has got an ARM license, or probably not for what people were expecting. ARM is licensing a legacy Cortex A5 processor to integrate with all future APUs starting in 2013. The point is security in the ARM ecosystem's trust zone. Essentially, rather than buy a company and have to do a custom proprietary security system like Intel did with McAfee, AMD is hoping that by integrating an ARM core with its own memory and systems on the chip, independent of the other CPU, GPU portions of the APU, they can easily and quickly offer similar services from phones to tablets to servers. While this isn't an ARM-based AMD processor like some expected, Ryan definitely considers it the first step down that road.
Interesting. So,
yeah.
And I was also reading today about how when you're dealing with the ARM processor in Windows 8, you're going to be limited too in terms of what code can be run on that platform as well. It's a lot more restricted with that particular CPU and that operating system. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of secure platforms or what AMD does next with this partnership.
We hope it's a secure platform.
That's the theory. Yeah. One does.
I'm sure they'll design a much more secure platform than I ever will. We come back in a second. We're going to talk to you about email questions from the audience. We love them. You can send them into us at Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. Mr. Ryan Shrout will be back next week. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. If you haven't seen it, you got to go over there, Squarespace.com. They've got a really easy-to-use user interface. The UI is sweet. Makes it easy to create, manage, whether you know your website, your blog, whatever you're putting online. And they've started giving out free domains to all annual plan customers so that you never have to pay for a domain or worry about hosting it. They're basically saying, look, it's integrated when you sign up, requires zero configuration. They essentially make domain selection and mapping seamless. And even if you decide to cancel Squarespace, the domain is yours to keep, which is pretty slick. They simplified their subscription plans and provided reduced pricing. The standard plans for Squarespace.com now cost a mere $8 a month. That is super cheap, people, because this makes it super easy to go in there. It's WYSIWYG. You move things around. You can get under the hood and put in your own code if you want to, but the idea is that Squarespace makes beautiful websites incredibly easy to make, and now it's even less expensive. If you're a CSS expert, you're golden. If you're a beginner, you're golden. They've got a developer-friendly CSS editor. You can pop the entire window in full screen, colorize code, undo, find, and replace. And then if you're kind of like, hey, I just want a website. I don't want a code. They have hundreds of templates at squarespace.com to choose from, and you can customize the designs to fit your need. They've got Android apps now along with the iPhone and iPad apps for updating your blog on the go. Google's complete web font library, over 300 fonts are fully integrated. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, you've got online resources and a special support team to help you make your website beautiful. Free live webinar classes to help you get the most out of your Squarespace site or blog. It's all inclusive. One monthly fee, everything's there. Modules to build your website, a blog module, a form builder. And actually, it's pretty cool because you can import or export. Import and export. So if you decide to leave Squarespace, they're okay with that. They're probably not that okay, but they actually give you the ability to export your blog to WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, or Typepad. The data is portable, people. The form builder can collect email addresses and other information from site visitors if they choose to give it to you. There's a Flickr photo display and a thumbnail or slideshow view, a Twitter widget, social media buttons, Google Maps, and quite a bit more. Website tracking, so you know how many times your site is viewed, and a built-in search engine optimizer, so you get your SEO sorted so people can actually find your website. And what's really cool is they basically scale. If for some reason, let's say you become really popular on Reddit or Mashable.com links to you, or you're on Boing Boing or wherever you show up, they basically host the websites in a way that they can automatically, seamlessly give you the capacity you need to deal with that gigantic swell in traffic. Build it, host it, update it anytime. Check out Squarespace for all your website needs. And we got a free trial for you, squarespace.com. You can sign up for a free account. No credit card is needed. You try it out. You start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase squarespace.com, and I bet you will, use the offer code TWICH6, T-W-I-C-H-6. You're going to get 10% off your purchase for your new account. Free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. 10% off with the Twitch, T-W-I-C-H-6. Code at squarespace.com. Use the offer code TWICH6, people. Check it out. This is nice, quality, beautiful, easy to do website hosting. It's all inclusive. We highly recommend you check out our sponsor, squarespace.com. And if you decide to buy, use that TWICH6 code. Thank you so much for supporting our show, Squarespace.
So, a deep breath, baby.
Up for an email question, Robert. Now that I've created a classic moment in editing. So
yeah, I've got a Squarespace account. I'm gonna set up something over there too. I gotta practice in their WYSIWYG engine. Cool looking system they have. I gotta just give it a shot. Dig into it and see what I can do with it. Put together something cool for myself.
So in the last Twitch episode, a couple episodes ago, we were talking about eSATA and how frustrating it could be. And we got an email. In the last Twitch episode, 172, I think you are too eager to kill eSATA for normal users. You're not familiar with eSATA. Okay, hold on. I'm not a big fan of the eSATA connection. I think the physical hardware connection to eSATA is just miserable. So I'm not a video editor and I don't work with video. I just back up my DVDs a couple times a year. But I regularly at home use an eSATA hard drive. Excuse me. regularly at home an eSATA hard drive is used to backup to bring to offsite for storage. I used to use USB 2.0 external disks, and it was slow when moving almost a terabyte of data. I have a question. Do you guys know of a defragmenting application where you could just write some defragmenting rules? Not just simple, if bigger than X megs or document type is X, move to end of disk. But would it be possible to move all the files in a specific folder to a specific disk place beginning at the end of the disk? And that's an interesting question. So
I'm not really sure if I understand the purpose here.
I don't know if I understand the purpose either, but
I mean,
so
for rotating media, I can see some right. points here. I mean, you want to make sure your data is contiguous,
right?
And in but at a certain point, I mean, what are the performance gains here?
Well, one of the things you get into is the farther the data is out on the platter, the faster it usually moves, right? Because the farther the head, as the head moves out to the outside of the platter, the hard drive platter, the data should be moving under it faster, if memory serves. So the idea is that if the data is pushed out to the outside of the rim, it should move fatter. I got to say, while I'm a big fan of defrag tools,
it's another benefit of going to an SSD. It's turning that crap off. Or there are, yeah. I mean, one of the benefits also of going to alternative operating systems is being able to choose different file systems. And some of them actually defragment a heck of a lot less than NTFS. You know, NTFS isn't supposed to fragment all that much anyway, but it does a little bit. I'm not the file systems expert, though, and I'd rather defer to...
Yeah, where's Alan? Well, it's kind of funny. It's like I'm familiar with like Smart Defrag is a great free defragging tool. Diskkeeper is pretty amazing. But I don't know off the top of my head of a tool that will, I can remember doing it in the dark, distant past, but I haven't seen any tools that allow me to easily and certainly not rule-based tools that allow me to figure out where I wanted to lay something down on a hard drive. So if you have an answer for that, a defragging application where you can actually actually move files around. It's kind of funny. Once you move files in a specific folder to a specific disk place, the beginning or the end of disk, that's an interesting thought.
I'm wondering
thought.
If anybody has that level of control anymore. You're not getting that in an SSD straight up, because the SSD is taking care of where it wants to put what, where, and when. And I have to think that even, and this would be a great question for one of the storage companies, but if they would even answer it, honestly, but they should. This isn't any secret sauce, I'm thinking, but that would be kind of cool to see, though, I think.
Would be really cool. Oh, wait, apparently Euchre says in the chat room, defragler will. I have never heard of defragler.
Okay.
Hopefully it's not something, hopefully I'm not having something terrible involving me. Opening up a website, my eyes falling out of my skull in shock. Defragler, pureform.com/defragler. Defrag your entire hard drive, individual files, features.
And I will say I do use eSATA on my external drives quite a bit. It is significantly faster than USB 2. And if you're moving a lot of data, which I've been moving several hundred gigs lately of audio, yes, it is worth having that interface if you can't just connect it directly to a SATA port or you're dealing with some sort of external interface.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of Defragler's more advanced features is the ability to move large files to the end of the hard drive. Your computer accesses files faster if they're at the start of the drive. Defragler can put the large files you probably don't use all that often, videos and archives, for example, at the end of the drive so that Windows can find the smaller files faster. So maybe it's the center of the drive that moves underneath the head faster. Simple enough for everyday users and flexible enough for those who demand the most options. Defragler is your best choice to take back control of your hard drive. So that's interesting. Interesting, interesting, interesting.
As Mal Ventano pointed out, remember, people, do not defrag an SSD, please.
Thank you,
that
Alan.
Should be disabled. That's the other thing. You got to be wary of even using cloning tools with SSDs. If you're moving from a rotating media to an SSD, oftentimes you're not going to enable all the special sauce that the operating system might have for the solid-state drive if you just simply copied the data as it was. Say you imaged your current notebook hard drive and just dumped it right over to an SSD. In many cases, it's best just to start clean with a clean install of the operating system using the operating system's install tools to get the full performance out of the drive. And it might be you're still going to get good performance moving up to an SSD either way, no matter how you use it. But the best way to use it's really, in my opinion, is to just do it at least that first initial install. Make sure you're doing it to a clean hard drive, freshly formatted, using the operating system. So it gets everything right the first time, then image away. And I believe at that point, it's safe to image an image back to a SSD. So anyway, if I'm totally confused the topic, I'll leave it that.
No. But also, Jake Ryan actually says 1974 says Disk Keeper will also do it, which is a feature I've never found inside of Disk Keeper. Mostly because I just defragment my drive and my system gets faster and I get all happy and wander off to do something else. Scott Michaud says, yes, it's a trade-off. Either leave the data closer to the edge where the disk spins fastest or leave enough space between data to allow for expansion.
It fascinates me that you can have that precise of control over data placement on a drive nowadays.
Not on an SSD, only on a physical ingester rotating hard drive. So yeah. Interesting. And yeah, if anybody wants to get some free performance, if you have a heavily fragmented drive, defragmenting it can actually do some pretty noticeable things in terms of how fast your applications open. Not an SSD on a traditional hard drive. And I've also noticed that even if it claims it's like less than 3%, defrag it, you'd sometimes be shocked how much faster Windows can feel when you're opening up applications. And all of the free defrag tools are much, much faster than anything inside of Windows. So,
and if you haven't reinstalled your operating system in a while, I think I've done that about 6 times in the last week for different computers, switching in and out of Windows 8 or back to Windows 7 or whatever. I think I even had one Ubuntu installation, but nothing beats a nice clean install on your hardware. It's just it's a great way to go, and it's a good excuse to back up all your data. So there, I'll quit harping on that.
Archon says, hey, Robert, what was the name of the program that helps keep your software on your PC up to date?
Sucunia PSI. I love saying that name. It's Secunia. You can do a Google search for that or your favorite search engine, and the PSI, the personal... software something or another, security something or other. Anyway, it's a great tool that just looks at a lot of common applications outside of stuff that would be caught by Windows Update and updates that for you. And it's a nice tool to have on a lot of Windows-based computers. I use it quite a bit, actually. Just about every computer, and definitely my parents' computers. Oh, my goodness. Anything you can do to help out there. Anybody who's less than technical and they need a little help keeping their stuff upgraded, that's a good tool to throw on for them. Checks all those little apps and hopefully will keep most of them patched up and help wrangle all those security flaws into a smaller and smaller corral, so to speak.
Smaller corral is always good.
I've also been using Nighttime too a lot lately. That's a great website if you haven't used it, just for updating systems. I've been rebuilding a lot of systems and
Nighttime's awesome.
Nighttime, yeah. And they even offer that as an update tool now as well. So if you don't want to install anything, you create your Nighttime link that has all your favorite applications. And then all that app does is really check their database for the latest version. So if you just rerun that app at any date in the future, sorry for shaking my camera there. If you rerun that app at any date, any future date, it's going to then check their database again and then basically update all those applications with the latest versions. So there's fundamental update feature built into that tool as well, in addition just to making a system rebuild an easier task.
Which is always a plus. We got an email on driver release schedules from AMD and NVIDIA, and I apologize. The name of the questioner got erased. Says, I can only hope, or her, says, I can only hope this has not been asked before, but here it goes. What's the deal with NVIDIA and AMD appearing to patch the drivers for pretty much every major game release? Why not for bargain bin games? Are they paying game developers to release games and take advantage of the features they provide, and the competition just needs to fix things in software? Shouldn't there be some kind of hardware abstraction layer or something? Actually, there is. It's called Windows. What kind of undocumented or weird things are game developers using that prompts AMD and NVIDIA to release patch software? What is the deal with driver game profiles? Are there things in the hardware not yet supported by drivers that need patches? Shouldn't NVIDIA and AMD build their drivers to take full advantage of hardware? Because it doesn't seem to be so now.
Gotta take a programming lesson sometime and realize that even minor changes in code can do unexpected things, and the optimizations that go into drivers specific to gaming, it's like every year, say you just take the feature set within DirectX and all the features that are available as far as new graphic candy that can be displayed on screen, and ensuring that the hardware, which, you know, is built by your competitors, the hardware might have bugs in it. So when you bring everything together, these driver updates are really the only glue they have to fix things after the fact. And granted, with game patches, you can patch software, and they often do, and there are bugs that way. But sometimes you either run into performance issues or you know, they're pushing so hard on the bleeding edge of what they can do with these graphics parts that the software companies want to ensure that their users and the people that buy their hardware are getting the best experience possible. So they're going to ensure that when they push these driver updates, usually a month later, after they've had a chance to get the game out or whatever to a wide audience and see what the problems are, then they go ahead and update their software and push that out, usually delivering not only the fixes for the glitches we've all encountered, but also hopefully improve performance for enabling people with even lower end hardware or older hardware then to enjoy those same apps at improved performance or fidelity. And that's really, I think, the key to it. And granted, going back and looking at older titles, well, you don't see much in the way of old software being fixed right down the road. The only time most companies will touch any software is if they're getting complaints about it and enough to affect their bottom line. Otherwise, right, they're just going to put their fingers in their ears and move on to the next project. So
I thought it was interesting. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I was listening to you now.
It was kind of funny. We didn't talk about it last week, but AMD, I was reading this article up on Antech.com. And AMD's actually dropped the monthly driver updates right around the time they released the Catalyst 12.6 beta. You know, and
that's fine, so too.
AMD's Trinity APU comes out. AMD's working on their Windows 8 drivers.
I'd rather have quality over quantity any day. So especially when it comes to driver updates, that's something I don't want to be playing with currently on a monthly basis from everyone.
No, not from everyone.
Oh no, not anymore.
Really, but from AMD, because like up until, you know, like June 1st, quote, for better part of a decade now, AMD, you know, formerly ATI, has released new WQL, Windows Quality Hardware Lab certified video drivers on a monthly basis. So the idea is that AMD has always offered driver updates on a schedule and, quote, to spread out major driver changes over a few versions of a driver. And literally, they've literally offered driver updates every month. And as Robert pointed out, you know, there's a lot of stuff you can do in little ways and drivers to make things better. But AMD has announced that starting with the Catalyst 12.6, AMD will be ceasing their monthly driver update schedule in favor of releasing drivers on a dynamic as needed basis, which is basically means they're doing exactly what NVIDIA has been doing for a long time. So cool. No more 12 monthly WHQL releases with, you know, beta and hotfix drivers.
You're going to have some happy driver coders, too. I mean, that had to be an incredibly demanding burnout schedule to be able to just keep dumping out those fixes. Or that would cause you to get into kind of a pattern where you might not be doing the best work possible on the code base when you're trying to stick to a schedule like that. So this sounds like a good move, and hopefully it'll just produce better code for all of us to use. So,
want to hear something amazing from that article? So the article, if you want to read it, AMD discontinues monthly driver updates on Antech.com. Check this out. AMD's drivers continue to grow in size and complexity, with the latest release weighing in at 170 megabytes. Video drivers have effectively eclipsed Windows 95 in complexity and size in the last couple of years, which basically GPUs are processors. The most transistor-dense object in the planet at this point is the top-of-the-line GPU. But, you know, it's essentially a small operating system.
It's true. And there's a lot of complexity. I wonder, though, the repetition of the part, though, when you do the layout on a chip, there are many repeated sections. And I wonder how much percentage-wise, say, your typical GPU is a repeated design, say, compared to your CPUs from Intel or AMD in terms of, I mean, you're dealing with very small, complex parts at very, very small sizes, but I'd like to see the engineers from both companies kind of do a one of it. It's like, oh, ours is far more complicated than yours, or you know, vice versa. A little one-upsmanship would always be fun.
One of the things the article points out is, like, you know, one of the nightmares of doing a monthly driver release, they ended up with the regular Catalyst release a BF3 release, a Battlefield 3 release, and a Rage release that didn't contain the BF3 improvements.
Frustrating for gamers, too, if you're trying to just to get, you know, adequate. It's bad enough dealing with the launch day game that's buggy, let alone not having adequate driver support, because everyone just loves to have, you know, day one, let's go full blast here. I mean, if you can take a break from a launch title for a month and let the bugs and the driver updates shake out, you're going to be a lot happier, I think, in the long run. But few people do that. Most people like to suffer. Or you just go console game and eliminate the whole damn driver nonsense problem altogether. Be happy.
Yeah,
but I love my PC gaming, and I will never give it up. So I'm right there with everyone else dealing with this stuff. So,
and we should also, you know, one other reason they might do a particular driver release for a major video game is because if their video driver is not compatible, you know, Diablo 3 was what, like 6 million sales in the first week. Now, maybe half those people can actually get online to play the game. But if you have an issue with compatibility with a major game release, imagine the core of the audience for buying new GPUs all being pissed off simultaneously because your hardware didn't work with the coolest new game on the planet. So that's a big reason why they do that.
Totally. And I'll be honest, a AAA title like Diablo 3 in particular, just my own personal experience, they've been fairly fast in aggressive updates lately. We'll see in another 6 months how things are, but the code base seems pretty tight now. Awfully fun. The biggest glitches I'm running into are related mostly to Windows 8. And if you're trying to run that title in Windows 8 currently, and you try to alt-tab in and out of it, it'll crash it immediately. And I just have some odd crashed desktops on starting it in Windows 8, but that's me playing in a beta operating system. So,
want to do a quick question about SSD placement? Jason
sure.
wants to know which he's getting. Jason says, due to recent price drops, one last question before we go. Due to recent price drops, Jason writes, I finally broke down and purchased a 128 gigabyte Crucial SSD. My question is, which system should I put it in, my laptop or my gaming system? My laptop is a Core i7-720 with 6 gigs DDR3, 500 gigabyte 7200 RPM drive with only 63 gigabytes used. My desktop has a Core i7-2700K with 16 gigabytes of DDR3 memory, boots off a 150 gigabyte Raptor 10,000 RPM drive, the sound of a jet taking off. That has about 85 gigabytes with a separate drive for storage. I use the laptop for basic tasks and a spreadsheet. I use the desktop for games and video editing and conversion. Which computer should I put it in to have the most impact?
Oh, man, that's tough. It sounds like you're using the desktop more than the notebook. So my first instinct would be just to put the drive into whatever system you're using the most. I mean, I'll always say it's going to feel great in any notebook. Upgrading a standard rotating media drive hard drive from a notebook up to a solid state drive is night and day. However, if you're doing a lot of intensive stuff on your workstation day in and day out, having that as a boot drive and an application drive for your most used applications is awesome. Just total subjective point here as far as gaming goes, at least. In Diablo 3, when you transition from one environment to another, there's a load time. And the SSD folks are experiencing just a flicker. It is like you are right. Boom, right into it. And I beat just about everyone else into the load scenario and when we reached the room. And so you can tell who the rotating media hard drive folks are. It's about 1 or 2 seconds behind us. They come popping in. And yeah, you know, I'm picking it there. But there's one real world example I could point out. In addition, it's just for notebooks though, it's startup and shutdown times. Notebook drives are just slow. Even the 7200 RPM notebook drives are generally, they feel sluggish compared to most desktop hard drives. So I'd say save up and buy that second drive quick and just have them in both and be done with it.
I'd start with a notebook. It's amazing how much faster hibernating gets along with everything else. I had to go from I went from a hard drive to an SSD, then back to a hard drive on a previous notebook, and it just killed me to realize how much slower launching applications, starting the machine, resuming from hibernate was. With the hard drive. That's probably going to be it for this edition of Twitch. What's coming up? Are you going to be reviewing that LG, the VT50?
Panasonic's VT50. I'm actually going into the studio on Saturday and setting that up and getting my network calibration on. That'll be interesting, actually. I think that'll be one of the very first TVs I've actually had a chance to access over IP to control it. And I'm really looking forward to trying that out. And it should be a phenomenal picture. So I'm expecting very good things out of arguably the best TV of the year in terms of picture quality. One of the best.
That would be a good thing. We've Techzilla, we've got that'll be up on HD Nation next week. We got the Dell XPS 1. It's on the website now, along with a very brief look at Thunderbolt versus USB 2.0 when you're talking about backing up drives. We're going to get a little more in depth with that. I'm following Alan's lead and getting a 77 motherboard with Thunderbolt on it, so I can really look at USB 3.0 and Thunderbolt side by side. Panasonic BT50 next week. And I believe we're doing ODB2 Bluetooth. So, with some of the secrets to how to get gauges and OBD2 access to data on your car on a tablet. It turns out it actually does cost more money to do it on the iPad.
Shocking.
Bluetooth serial not enabled on the iPad, but I'll talk more about that next on Techzilla. Ladies and gentlemen, Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware is what you're listening to right now. My name is Patrick Gorton.
And my name is Robert Herron, and I'm glad to be here.
Thanks, Robert. We'll see you next week on Twitch.